And I think that's one of the things you can do with art, is make an image that is critical, but it allows people to think about it, you know. I mean, I don't consider what I do propaganda, because I'm not telling people, go and do this or go and do that. I'm actually just pointing out these things and joining things together that are usually separate.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Art Persists podcast, a series by Bostler Arts offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. My name's Georgia and today we are joined by London-based artist and activist Peter Kennaert. Since the 1970s, Peter has produced some of our most iconic and influential images of resistance and dissent, from the Vietnam War, anti-apartheid movement, campaign for nuclear disarmament, and most recently, campaign against the war in Ukraine and the siege on Gaza. I chat to Peter about his incredible life's work, spanning 5 decades where he's dedicated his art and activism towards anti-war movements, anti-capitalist movements, anti-corporation movements, and so much more. We chat about his latest exhibition, Archives of Dissent, which is currently taking place at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. Hope you enjoy. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the Art Persists podcast. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much. So your latest exhibition, Archive of Dissent, is currently on display at the Whitechapel Gallery in London, showing the work from the last 5 decades. We're going to get into it more, but I wanted to ask you as the first question, just how you're reflecting on it. How has it felt to open the show and kind of look back on the last 5 decades of your work?
Yeah, well, I'm really pleased to be showing the Whitechapel. It's got a special history for me. I'm from London. I used to go. In fact, I went there in the first show I saw, like, of Rauschenberg, was 1974. All that time ago. Yeah, and and also the fact that it's in the East End, and it's, you know, and it was very connected to its radical past. The area I'm showing in was the library, Whitechapel Library. And that was used by, originally it was used by a lot of the Jewish emigres, including writers and artists, and then by the Bangladeshi community and it was a meeting place for people, and they came to look at newspapers and talk and to stay warm. Now, most of them were living in poverty, so they didn't, you know, they went there, and it's got that atmosphere to it still. So I've tried to make a show that sort of reflects that in some way by putting a lot of newspaper work I've done in it and using the sort of furniture of the library. So in that way, it's got its own history to it. So I'm really pleased to be showing there.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I really like the kind of reading aspect of it as well, because I liked just sitting on those tables as well, just reading through the books that you've written and that kind of thing. It makes it a really nice space to just go to, actually. So it's really powerful.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very much based on the history. I can feel the history of the place when I'm in there. So
yeah.
And obviously the Whitechapel is, you know, it's really unusual because it's an East End gallery, and the East End's got this enormous tradition of radicalism and anti-fascism, yeah. You know, Cable Street's down the road, and there's that whole aspect of it.
Absolutely. And so tell us a bit about your early life. Where did you grow up and what was life like?
What was life like? Well, I grew up in London in Paddington, and in a flat there, and I started painting. I got into painting, and there was a coal shed down in the bottom of our flats that stopped being used because they stopped using coal, you know, it became a smokeless.
Yeah.
So I used that as a studio. I went in, I turned it into a studio when I was about 13.
Oh.
And started painting. And I just got totally into painting and being very influenced by different people like Bacon and Giacometti, and it was that sort of period doing figurative art. And then I went to school in Marylebone Drama School, and it was I couldn't stand it really, so I left at 16 and went to a place called Byam Shaw School of Art, which was great. And then I went on to the Slade in, you know, when I was 18. So that was in the late 60s. So it was a pretty wild time to be a student. Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
Amazing. Did you come from a kind of political activist family? Was that something that was talked about a lot at your home?
My dad was had wanted to be an artist himself.
Mm.
And he went for a year to art school, but they couldn't afford it anymore, so he stopped and he went into advertising. And so he was very, you know, in a sense, he was always disappointed artist in that way, that he would have liked to have carried on with it, but he didn't.
Yeah.
So, but he took me to a lot of exhibitions. We went, you know, like to the Whitechapel and Camden Art Centre and all the sort of public galleries around. So they were very receptive to, you know, the fact I wanted to be an artist. My parents didn't fight it. My mum was a secretary, and she was very into, especially the sort of work I did then. They got a bit upset at some of the stuff that was got more and more political and less.
Yeah.
And less like stuff you want to put on the wall, basically.
Mm.
and then, so I went to Sladen, and then I got involved in the, there was a lot of demonstrations against the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And it was the time of the war. So it was then that I went on the big demonstration, Grosvenor Square. It's quite famous now, the 68 one, where the police were let loose on their horses and quite violent. So I wanted to find a way to make work that related to what was going on. And that's when I stopped doing painting, in a sense, because painting I felt had it's got this great history. So it becomes more of a formal thing in terms of, you know, when you look at it, you're looking at it in relation to the whole history of painting. So, well, that's how I felt at the time. And then, so I started using photography and getting photos of Vietnam, what was going on, and of what was going on in the civil rights movement in the States, and finding a way to amalgamate all these things. I put them, all these images, onto negative, and then sandwiched the negatives together, and made these sort of multiple images that showed the sort of relationship between, like the people that were supporting the protests against the Vietnam War and the war itself and the civil rights, and putting them all together, and made a whole series of paintings about that.
Yeah. I think that's it's one of the reasons why I really like your work, is the kind of, it's actually something that we try and do a lot at Bosla Arts as well, which is to look at how everything is connected to us, nothing that's going on in any other part of the world is disconnected to us, and it's just about finding ways to kind of show people that they can relate and that they should care about these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've done, and I do a lot of workshops with different groups, and often with an artist called Kat Phillips, who I've worked with over the years. And we bring tons of magazines and computers and scanners and things, and then people can relate, you know, like especially young people. We've done quite a lot with really young people, and they can pull out a page about from a car advert and put it next to their own photos and start making things. One of the things about, you know, sort of capitalism is that things aren't related in terms of imagery. You know, you get your adverts and then you get something else. Whereas with montage, you can, or just cutting things together, is quite a revelation for people in terms of thinking about their own situation and thinking about their sort of political beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's actually a quote from something you wrote that I just wanted to read out, because I think it just sums it up so well. You said, "My photo montages attempt to rip apart the smooth, apparently seamless surface of official deceit to expose the conflict underneath." And I think it says it so well, because you whether you're talking about like capitalism or conflict or, you know, wars or arms sales, it's always this sense of like the official narrative or the shiny product that's being shown. Yeah. And then you contrast it with the reality of it.
Yeah. It's one of the things about our system is that you get, you know, like arms companies, they produce these glossy leaflets of bombs and bullets and put them in vitrines in the arms fair, XL arms fair. And they're completely, obviously, they're separated from the victims of it. You don't see that, you know. And at the moment, with what's going on in Gaza, I mean, that's been a terrible revelation for people to see this horror of all these children, and you know, women and children and everybody, all Palestinians, you know, under the rubble.
Yeah. Those
are the things you don't, and you obviously don't see much of that on the official news, but you see it online, you know, on Twitter.
Absolutely.
You know, I think the sort of deceit and inhumanity of our, you know, political system has really got through to people, especially to, you know, it's got through to young people. I mean, I think the fact that students in the States and here have been, you know, camping outside their universities in support of Palestine has been fantastic. It's been really optimistic that it's got through to them, the reality of it.
Absolutely. I think it's so, you know, it's just one of those big moments, I think, that changes people's perceptions.
Yeah, I think it's a real, real game changer. I mean, to see the day after day, the horror is something that, I mean, I've never seen it experienced, because obviously now people are filming it on their mobiles, and to actually see the sort of total inhumanity of what's going on, you know, and they're aiming it. They've destroyed almost destroyed the whole of Gaza. All the universities have gone. The hospitals are nearly gone, you know. And the children are being shot. And it is a ongoing horror. And you know, it's something that is quite new in a sense, I think, to see it, and it's still going on. You know.
And I wanted to kind of reflect on what's going on in Gaza with you, actually, because, you know, you've mentioned before that this sort of idea that you're like the feeling of drowning when it comes to the mass influx of images that we see. And as you've mentioned, what's slightly different about what's going on in Gaza at the moment is that obviously we have social media, but also video footage. So we are, you know, you just look on your phone and you are watching, you know, you can watch people dying, children dying constantly.
Yeah.
How do you feel about, because I think then the other side is that once people start to see it a lot, they actually become accustomed to it in a way, you know, slightly fatigued. It's a strange feeling of like, you know, I feel like at the beginning it was so, everyone was so upset and angry, and people still are, but there's also a slight weird fatigue that comes with endless videos. How do you reflect on it, and what role do you think maybe, you know, for photo montage or art comes with it as well?
Well, I think, you talk about a fatigue. I think it's also people can't stand looking at it every day.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, to see, you know, kids' legs coming out from under the rubble and whatever. Mm. I mean, it's, and, you know, people I've talked to said, you know, stop looking at it because they can't take it.
Yes.
So I don't think it's fatigue so much as horror, and then knowing that you can't actually, there isn't much you can do. You know, we go on marches every fortnight, which are important because it's, you know, you get a fantastic range of people of ages and nationalities and a feeling of comradeship from it. Mm-hmm. But there isn't, you know, a lot you can do. We've now got a Labour government that's doing bugger all about it.
Yeah.
Pretending to take away, where it's just taken away some licenses for arms, but very small number.
Yeah, so, 50 or something.
So there is that feeling of, you know, like what can you do? And I suppose with imagery, with montage, it's just another way to symbolize it. And I've tried to do things that, I mean, most of them don't work. It's very difficult to make something about something so horrific while it's going on. So it's more like I did one of the Palestinian flag with a sort of the triangle of the red triangle becoming like blood dripping.
Mm.
And I think that sort of image might work because it's symbolic and then it stays in people's minds.
Yeah.
But it's something that you can look at. So, I mean, it's a big question in political art. How much horror do you put in, you know?
Mm.
Or does that stop people from looking?
Yeah.
Which, you know, there's a guy called Thomas Hirschhorn, and you know his work? Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, he does really strong images. I mean, he takes the news images and of you know, the sort of massacres and the horrors. But in some ways, that's, to me, that's not giving people a space to think about it. And I think that's one of the things you can do with art.
Yeah.
Make an image that is critical, but it allows people to think about it, you know. I mean, I don't consider what I do propaganda because I'm not telling people, go and do this or go and do that.
Mm.
I'm actually just pointing out these things and joining, like you talked about, joining things together that are usually separate, you know.
Yeah.
You never see the politicians with the slaughter in the same image. It's one of the reasons for making montage, you know, so that you can put them together.
Yeah.
And I think that's important to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And obviously, like, throughout your whole career, you've done it in such important moments and to such powerful, you know, effects, whether it's, you know, the bomb, Hiroshima bomb with the skeleton, which makes which forces people, I think, to think about what actually happened rather than this image of like a huge, you know, mushroom cloud.
Mushroom cloud, yeah.
Yeah.
A poster that people called Athena, who used to have all these poster shops around the country, and they had a fucking great poster airbrushed of a mushroom cloud with no words on it, and that was supposed to be, and it was very popular.
Mm.
It, you know, as a sort of thing to put up in your bedroom, it became. So that's originally why I did those images. That when the cruise missiles came, I got involved with CND, and I wanted to do something that actually, if you look at that image of mushroom clouds, you connect it to what it caused, which was, you know, 200,000 deaths in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's making that connection in one image. And that relates, I mean, people sometimes think it relates to sort of Dadaism and that sort of way. But in fact, it's more about surrealism, I think, because surrealism, you're trying to join images together. And in my montages, I try and join images so they have a reality about them. It's not like spread out across as a collage. It's put together so that I find one image and then another image and they seem to fit together. It's that fitting together that's important, you know.
Definitely. I think one of the examples that you've done of that has really stayed with me is of apartheid in South Africa, where you have a European-only woman bench with a woman sitting on it, and then this really horrific scene underneath, and that kind of contrast really brings it into the forefront of like what was going on there.
I mean, it's that contrast and that idea of people looking away. You know, I mean, it's interesting that I don't know if you saw that film that's about the Nazis living next door to the Auschwitz.
I actually haven't seen it yet.
It's very powerful.
But I know the one you mean about the garden.
Yeah, the garden. Yeah, but he the director talks about a sort of ambient genocide. You know, it's ambient because it's going on while we're living our lives separately, you know, from that. I mean, it's a bit like what's going on now with Gaza, you know. We're continuing, but we know this thing's going on, with, you know.
Exactly.
Hi, this is Hossam Fazula, co-founder of Bosla Arts. The Art Persists podcast is independently run by Bosla Arts, me and Georgia, which allows us to share these important conversations with artists and activists from all over the world. In order to keep having these conversations, we need your help. Join us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us continue this vital work. More info in the episode description. Now back to the podcast.
I think another thing that you do so well is kind of talking about how in conflicts, the occupied people are so dehumanized. And I think, I mean, just relating it back to Gaza, we're seeing it a lot with the kind of narrative that is coming out. But obviously, you did so much on Iraq and really looking at how this idea of dehumanizing the people to also justify collateral damage as well, so collateral damage. And this idea that civilian deaths are justified for the greater cause.
Yeah.
How have you tried to kind of challenge dehumanization in your work, do you think?
Well, it's not, the work I do is not, a conscious, you know, I don't sort of decide in a sense. It's something that is quite emotional, you know, and I try and just respond to things as they're happening. Hopefully I give the people that are the victims of all the horror, you know, give them a humanity that, as you say, is extinguished in these wars and that we've got going, you know, like in Iraq, there's different estimates, but probably nearly a million people died. If it's something that, if it's just an ongoing thing, that's why I went on. And I made a lot of work with Cat Phillips at that time, and we just wanted to keep the memory going of it in different ways.
Yeah.
In the work, you know, it's that thing of keeping going with it. Mm. And, you know, and the awful thing is I've been doing this sort of work for about 50 years, and of course it's still relevant. The stuff, you know, the stuff of CND, we're spending $150 billion on reconditioning Trident, and and American missiles are coming back to Lakenheath at the moment. They're building underground silos for them. So all these things, you know, and people say, well, you know, it must be a good feeling that you've done it. Then these things are still around, but it's not really a good feeling, because the fact that they're still around, you know, means that they're not exactly successful. But images, I mean, I never believe images can, you know, art can do it on its own. But, you know, I think it can do it as a visual arm of the organizations. That's why, you know, like with the Palestinian flag, when I gave it to Stop the War, who's selling it as a poster. So giving it to the organizations that are involved. And obviously, sometimes I get images from them, then I turn it into a poster or something, and then they can sell the poster because they've funding for these things is all from supporters, you know. They've got So there is a sort of circle sometimes in the work with that.
Absolutely. And obviously, like, your work has also appeared on, you know, in many protests, and the power of like seeing them. How does that feel when you see your work being used alongside a movement or a protest?
Well, I mean, it's good. I mean, I believe that art shouldn't, from what I do, is I don't want it to be esoteric just for an art audience. I mean, I really believe in galleries, because they're the one place where people can spend time with work and look at it in a different way. But I also like to make work that can be used on demos. And if the work is what I consider good enough, or in my eyes good enough, then it can also be shown in a gallery. I mean, I've never had a thing about, I know some of my students in the past have, you know, they say to me, you know, I've been offered this show at the gallery, do you think it'll be good for my career? And I think, well, you know, you should show it anyway. I mean, when I left art school, if you could get a show in a mixed show in a library, you thought, wow, great, I'm going to show some.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's really important to show, especially the sort of stuff I do. So it goes on T-shirts and it goes on badges and posters and it was a lot in the independent press Yeah, and the sort of post-hippie lefty press that doesn't exist in the same way now because it's mostly online.
Yeah.
I do always push organizations to try and make, like if they're having a demo, to make posters that can go up in the street.
Mm.
You know, then it's fighting all the enormous capitalist posters that are selling all this crap to us.
Yeah.
And it becomes a shock in the street to see it. Whereas online, there is this thing of a bubble of people who will see it. And that's a problem, I think, you know.
Absolutely. And it does, when you see something in the street that is not an ad, it does shock you. You know, it's
it does,
makes you look at it more.
Yeah. People wonder what it's selling, you know, to start with, because we're so attuned to that idea of all these ads selling our stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
And even the opposite way, I remember I think I was in Shoreditch a few months ago and I saw a mural painted and I was like, wow, what is this mural? It looks so nice. Blah, blah, blah. And then I realized it was an advert for Netflix that they had painted as a mural.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I remember in Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, she talks about, you know, like I think it was Nike, mm-hmm. some of their big ads, they actually employed graffiti artists to graffiti over them, you know. It was cool. It's, you know, made them cool. So there is that thing of the, you know, we used to call it repressive tolerance, which is a term Marcuse used, which is like the establishment and the system takes it in and then uses it as product, you know, like all these. Yeah. I mean, there was a period when all the clothes shops and are called Che Guevara and things like that. You know?
Oh, yes.
So it's something that one's got to fight. And I always think with montage, it's quite difficult to change the meaning. It does get ripped off a lot all over the place, my stuff. But if it's by people that believe in the same things as I do, then that's fine, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's difficult for other people to engage with it. Although, I mean, saying that, I've got to be honest, there's one in the show of Margaret Thatcher as Queen Victoria, a montage. And I was told by, I went to an opening of a cartoon show, and there were all these Tories love cartoon. But one of them said, oh, yes, Margaret has that in the bog at number 10. She loves it. That is a failed montage. I don't know if it's true or if you said it to wind me up, but
oh my god, it's
yeah,
horribly believable. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that is something, that sort of thing one's got to watch out for. There was a Cuban painter that used to paint people in the fields, sort of cutting sugarcane things with a overseer. In the painting, a sort of realist painting, and the overseer wanted to buy the painting because he thought that was the way you should be treating the workers, you know, in the fields. So there's that problem with that, you know.
Yeah. God, it's always difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
Peter, I wanted to ask you also a bit about censorship, because you were famously censored by the Barbican in 1985 for a series of works you created in response to the 1973 military coup in Chile led by General Pinochet, which became one of the most brutal reigns of terror on the Chilean people.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us a bit about that experience of censorship?
Yeah. Well, I had a show that was called In the Pit Area at Barbican, and it went with a series of anti-war plays by a playwright called Edward Bond, who was great. Mm. He's not that well known now, and probably because he was very anti-war. But I had help putting the show up, and then just on the night before, it was going to open the next day, and the director of the Barbican, not the director of the gallery who'd done it, but of the whole Barbican. Mm. And his name was Henry Wrong, spelt like Wrong, which is a brilliant name for. And he came down and said, we can't have that. There were two works, and they showed sort of torture in Chile. Well, one of them showed a Chilean soldier and then a bandaged head next to it. And he said, oh, we can't show those because we've got a Chilean minister coming tomorrow, finance minister, who's going to talk to British bankers. And he might get, you know, unhappy about it. And the other one showed us a slaughterhouse. I mean, Chile was a slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
Total slaughterhouse of the people. And I'd actually taught a lot of Chilean students who'd escaped after the coup at Northeast London Poly when I was teaching there. So that anyway, the people who put it up refused to take this big thing that we'd hung from the ceiling down. But the next day we came there and they'd covered it in a blanket, a sort of felt blanket. It looked like sort of Joseph Boyce hanging up there.
Yeah.
And the other one, the smaller one, they'd unscrewed from the wall. And it showed, you know, I mean, the Barbican, famously, there's been an exhibition about Palestine, you know, that where they stopped a speaker doing a lecture about Palestine recently, and the artist put signs up about it. You know, and this was at the time when the blood was flowing in Chile. It was, you know, and yet they would rather not shock a Chilean minister while that was going on. So, yeah, so they covered it in a blanket. And of course, it got more publicity because of that. That's the thing about censorship.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And they said they weren't censoring it in the letter to the Guardian and things, you know. So, yeah, it does happen. And another one I did was, it was Bob Geldof. So Bob, he commissioned some artists to do stuff for a Christmas sort of celebration of Christmas by having projections on public buildings.
Mm.
And I did one of a based on a painting of the Virgin Mary that's in the National Gallery, and I changed the halo into a peace symbol, and then in her where her face was, I put a picture of the Earth. You know, it's quite simple. It's quite anodyne. I mean, it wasn't shocking, and I waited, and I didn't hear anything from Bob, and I contacted them, and he said, "Oh, you've got to talk to Orange." I don't know if you remember. Orange has gone. At that time, they were a big mobile phone manufacturer. You know, they were a big corporation, and they were sponsoring this thing, and mine was going to go up by the river in a government on a building. I don't think it was a government building, but it was an old building. And the woman at Orange, when I contacted, she wrote a letter to the Guardian saying, this image would be offensive to young women, no, to young children and grandmothers. She actually put that, young children and grandmothers would be offended by it. And it was during the time when these amazing grandmothers went across a loch in Scotland on a boat and smashed up a nuclear submarine, very famous action, you know, very brave women. So they wouldn't show it, and they showed a big projection of Nigella's mince pies instead.
Oh, for God's sake.
So, you know, it does happen. I mean, most of in our society, most of the thing is censorship by exclusion in the art world.
Yeah.
You exclude the political work. And at the moment, of course, there's the whole thing of exclusion in relation to Gaza. And here and in, I mean, in Germany, it's incredible. You know, you just can't mention it. But it happens here. But it happens more than one knows because people are excluded, you know.
Definitely.
So you don't hear about it in the sense of it actually reaching that point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a kind of, I guess also with, you know, social media now is that people can express themselves but also be excluded or censored because of it. And it is a big issue. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, I've been really lucky. The Whitechapel have been completely open with me, and they've allowed, you know, they haven't censored anything that I wanted to put up in it, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think something like the Tate, I mean, you know, the Tate, one thing it should have done display of Palestinian artists' work. Should be doing that now. I should be responding to what's going on in the world.
But yeah.
No, there's nothing like that there.
Nothing.
And
I think it, you know, what happened to you also at the Barbican speaks of this issue that's happening now with culture here, which is also the kind of shrinking of public funding. So, you know, lots of institutions are really reliant on these private donations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's, you know, the Sackler scandal as well is a good example.
I mean, sponsorship is the big problem, you know, because it has got strings attached and they don't want to, you know. I mean, I remember, I think it was at the Tate they did it. They couldn't find a sponsor is some time back for Francis Bacon, you know, because it was a bit too visceral. I mean, now, but you know, yeah, anything. I mean, it's okay to do a sort of birth, copulation and death, you know, like sort of Damien Hirst sort of, he does a lot about death, but if you angle it in to particular corporations or name anything, then, you know, they don't want it, you know, because sponsors would react and they wouldn't support it, you know. I mean, I think a lot of the YBA, that whole thing was to do with the fact that their work looked very visceral and gritty, but it didn't actually particularly angle itself at anything in the political system, you know.
Yeah,
exactly. In that way. Yeah.
I
mean, I'm not saying they should, you know. I always say, and in my teaching, I've never pushed any student. I mean, I've made a living doing this sort of work because I've had a teaching job. I've been, you know, I come from a very privileged time. I mean, my generation is completely privileged compared with the shit we've left your generation. You know, and I mean, when I went to art school, I had a grant. I had my fees were paid. I lived in a squat, you know. Which is now illegal. Squats get you out straight away. Yeah, all those things that happened. So, you know, nowadays with students, I never tell them to do a certain sort of work because obviously with making political type work, you're not going to make a living from it particularly.
You know?
I mean, all the groups I work with, I've never got money from CND or anything like that. I've just given them, you know. So, and of course, young artists now do get sponsorship from different companies. And again, I'm not critical of that. I mean, I wouldn't do it myself, but they've got, you know, people have got to live.
Yeah.
So it's so difficult now to be, especially in London, to be an artist, you know, and to find somewhere to live and to get a studio. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
And so you're a professor of political art at the Royal College of Art.
Well, I'm retired now.
Oh, you're retired?
I retired 3 months ago on my 75th birthday.
Oh, my goodness. Congrats.
So I'm an emeritus, or whatever they call it, professor now.
How does it feel?
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was teaching there nearly 40 years. And then before that at other art schools, and so I mean it's great, but it's, you know, it is terrible what's happening in art education, that the public money is only in really there for a bit of research now, so everything has to be got from fees and sponsorship and have you, so and tons of students coming in. So it's, you know, and Brexit has made it worse. We've got some amazing students from Europe, and there's no way they will come now because of overseas rates are enormous for students.
Yeah.
So
it's really upsetting.
It's got very difficult, but you still get, you know, those great moments in teaching when you get great students and one can work with them sort of organically, you know. Outside, there's a lot of curriculums in teaching now, art schools, which I think is bollocks, a lot of that, you know. art schools are about people meeting and the students meeting each other and suddenly coming up with something. I mean, there's one group I work with, mainly female students it was, and they came from all over the fine art and humanities thing in Royal College, and they formed a group called RAGE, R-A-G-E, and they're still going, you know. I mean, they got together and they're all doing work about their own countries, but through that, and that's something that you can't legislate for, you know, you can't legislate for a lot of stuff in art schools.
Yeah.
It happens, you know.
Amazing. Well, Peter, I've taken a lot of your time. So my final question to you is really, how are you feeling about the future? I mean, we've talked a lot about the past and the current day, but obviously we've got a new government after more than a decade of Tory rule. Are you feeling positive and hopeful of the future? How are you reflecting on it?
Well, I feel positive about young people, you know, like who've been campaigning against what's going on in Gaza and campaigning about climate big time, which is so important. I mean, I don't feel optimistic about Labour government. I did actually join Labour for a time when Jeremy Corbyn was leader, and he was an amazing, inspiring influence, you know. I did some stuff at one of the, when they were in Brighton, they had the conference when he was leader. And there were hundreds of young people. You could see they were really fired up, really hopeful, and of all different sorts. You know, they were very non-denominational in that sense, like anarchists and whatever, but they all felt that this guy was real, you know, speaking for them. And that feeling was great, and I'm hoping that you know feeling will. I mean, it's not there in the Labour Party now.
Yeah.
But I think because of the you know, we're living in a time of emergency, so that all the sort of people campaigning against, you know, climate catastrophe and all that, and all the young people doing it. You know, that's what I'm optimistic about. You know, I'm not optimistic about the state, which will be, you know, they imprisoned five Just Stop Oil people for 5 years and
Shocking.
4 years.
So those
women got 4 years. And the bloke got, I think, 5. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's you know, it's struggles on. I think like everybody, some days you wake up and think, oh, fuck, what can I do? It's terrible. And other days, mainly through people being together, you actually feel optimistic. I mean, is that how you feel?
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's why it's so important to also like just physically. I think that's why also the protest for Gaza are so powerful, actually, because you kind of, you feel very alone and upset, and then you come together.
Yeah.
And you realize you're not alone and that people care. And
And also people in Gaza are seeing it.
Yeah.
They do know that they've got this amazing support all over the world from the demonstrations. Yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And
I
just really look forward to seeing what you do next.
And best of luck with your project. I think it's great.
Thank you so much. We'd like to thank Peter Kennard for joining us for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about his work, please find links in the episode description. And if you're London-based, definitely don't miss out on his incredible exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery. And thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Art Persist podcast. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, we just ask that you rate us, follow us, and share your favourite episode with friends and family. Only with your help can these incredibly important stories be heard. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with a new episode.